it actually possible to see yourself as you actually are?
We are an amalgam, at least four different versions of ourselves.
Once you've started going down the rabbit hole, you can't shut Pandora's box again.
You've essentially got these four little advisors inside of you. You've got your instincts, you have your personal experience, a kind of cultural mind, and a capacity for rational thought. And each one of these can take a swing at whatever pitch is thrown at them.
The doctor might present that back as evidence, saying, if you fix this thing in your life, you will be better. Then why would the person's response not be to immediately fix that thing?
Well, because instincts are running the show and they're off to whatever the instincts does to make them feel more in control and less anxious. When you say, I have preferences for, I go to, well, which version of you? And if the version of you that is expressing those preferences really is dominant and flexible, your instinctual mind has preferences for things that make sense to it.
Is it possible to persuade someone, or must they persuade themselves? Siggy, thanks for being here.
Hey, nice. Thanks you guys for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, no, I'm excited for this one. I'm very excited. So before we get into it, we always start our podcast off the same way. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
I am a brain scientist, and I have been working tirelessly for over 20 years now to try to understand essentially the brain's OS. The operating system of the nervous system. So I do systems neuroscience, which means I work at that sort of high level of functionality, looking at large systems and how the large systems interact to inform really the topic of neurodiversity and the way people form experience and make decisions.
Interesting. Okay. And for someone listening to this, is there a particular type of person that you typically help with that? Do they need to have a certain set of symptoms that make it worthwhile listening to the rest of the episode?
Well, when I was in academia, so in my past life, I was a professor at UCLA doing research. And so in that context, I really was just a pure academic, you know, building the body of knowledge for academia. In 2015, I moved into the private sector because doing some consulting work, I kind of discovered a joy for putting scientific knowledge into action to try to solve real world problems. And I was, you know, I very much enjoyed doing that. And so since 2015, I've been doing more market research oriented work. And I would qualify that by saying, I didn't jump into doing traditional market research. Instead, what I've been doing is kind of bridging the gap between formal sort of neuroscientific academic approaches to understanding humans and sort of merging that with traditional market research methods, concepts, and approaches. So I've been playing this role of trying to integrate between the two worlds, which has been very interesting on a number of different levels. Yeah.
Nice. Siggy, it's great to have you on the podcast. I sometimes like to go around the houses with my question, but I'm going to ask it in a very simple way today. When you think about the brain, what are some of the surprising things that the brain can do when it comes to influencing our decisions?
Oh, wow. So that delves right into the heart of it. And it relates to the challenge that I've been really facing as I've entered into market research. So maybe I could take that by stepping back a little bit and talking about what are the big differences that I've encountered in being an academic, trying to understand human behavior versus kind of entering the fray of market research. So in market research, historically, they've been really focused on understanding what I think of as what research, kind of getting lots of information about what's happening, what people are doing. And that even delves down to the level of like, what kinds of features do people like about a certain package design or things like that? Do they like this or do they like that? And nevertheless, it's still operating in this domain of what phenomenology, like what's going on, where are people's eyes and attention going, where are their preferences settling. Where I've been working is more at why people do those things. And so that opens up the topic of why people would choose, you know, something over something else. And that's an entirely different domain of inquiry. Like, and the complexity of it and the difficulty of it is hard to express how different it is to ask the question, you know, what color does somebody like? Oh, I like blue. Why do I like blue? And delving into the neural underpinnings of what would drive those kinds of preferences. And getting that aspect of understanding of consumers into market research has been the cross that I've been bearing, and trying to create mechanisms, try to acculturate ideas, trying to develop nomenclature, means of communicating to be able to interact with people in the market research space, to kind of delve into that. And so to before I'd even explain, like, what are the nuances of understanding decision-making psychology, it's important to kind of characterize the problem. And the problem really is demonstrated by, you know, we could do lots of things to go, yes, this person likes blue, this person doesn't like blue, but it's really, why do they like blue? And what are the decision-making mechanisms that are fomenting those kinds of sentiment? So I don't know if that's clear, but that's kind of the setting of the stage that would enter into a conversation around the question that you just asked.
And then where do you typically start if you're trying to understand the why? And I'm sure that everybody's individual. Where would you start on that journey then, Siggy?
So, I have to be, and this is part of the learning that I've been doing over the past 10 years is how to communicate these things. Cause there's a scientific talk track trajectory, and then there's a more, friendly to the public talk track trajectory. And I'll try to stay on that. So, broad brush strokes to really get an understanding consumer, the whys behind consumer decision-making, you have to know a couple key things. You have to know the type of decision event that they're up against, and you have to know the type of decision machinery that's in play to make those decisions. So just briefly, when we think about decision, yeah, and this relates to this idea, to just step back a second, that like nature plus context equals behavior, you know, the whole kind of nature-nurture thing, it's always both. And when I talk about a decision event, I'm talking about a contextual factor. And then in a second, I'll talk about the decision machinery, which is the nature factor, right? And so the context here is when a brand is developing, and this is, again, kind of connects together my academic work and the work I've been doing for the past 10 years in the market research space. But the model is that when a brand is developing, there are three key types of decisions that they have to pass through. The first one can be thought of as decisions associated with trial. Like, will I try this, right? And there's a kind of decision and psychological machinery that goes into that kind of a proposition. Later, they'll get to a point where people are deciding, well, I've tried this several times. It's a point of interest to me. I'm going to onboard something into my more regular daily life routine and pattern behavior. Like, I'm going to decide to make this, like, going from dating to like getting engaged. Like, I'm going to now going to make a choice about something that I'm going to use more durably and has become a more regular part of my life and lifestyle. And we think of that as choice. That's a different kind of decision-making event where you're having to make A versus B type of decisions where you're deciding, am I going to put this in my basket or that in my basket? Whereas during trial, you can walk into a store and be like, I like all the beer. And, you know, I'm going to do this today and that tomorrow. Da, da, da. But people eventually will start to routinize their behavior and get one beer over others more regularly in a patterned way. And that's a different kind of decision. And then further out, people will fall into routinized or automated habitual behavioral patterns where they're just doing something because they're used to doing it. They've done it for a long time. There really isn't a decision happening there per se, but there's a different kind of psychology that's really important in so much as there's a way to protect a routinized behavior or an automatic behavior. Whereas the last thing you want to do is sort of disrupt somebody's automaticity or flow once you've got them in a routinized behavior. And brands make those kinds of mistakes all the time. And there's a whole psychology around optimizing and facilitating a behavior that has become habitualized. So simply, it's like trial, choice, and routine. So those are three kinds of things that brands have to succeed at as they're trying to grow. And once you understand what kind of decision event a brand is up against, then you have to understand the type of decision-making psychology or machinery that their target consumer audience is wielding. And that's where we have to enter into the fray of a kind of deeper conversation about how decision-making processes work in the human brain. So I'll pause there before I go on in case there's any comments or thoughts.
How much then of decision making, so let's say buying decision making, if I'm going to make a purchase, is made by the emotional part of the brain rather than the logical part?
Yeah, so this is where we can grow that concept in ways. So it's, yes, there's like emotionality, there's logic, and there's the fast thinking, slow thing nomenclature that's out, but there's a deeper way of understanding this. And the good news is that it's not actually super complex. To put it simply, across evolution, humans have devised, we continue to try to evolve mechanisms that get better and better at making predictions about things in the world that will help us or hurt us. So like the brain is mainly a prediction making machine. It's constantly trying to make guesses like, is this going to help me or is this going to hurt me? And it never has enough information to be 100% confident. So it's really like a probabilistic prediction making mechanism, the human brain and all nervous systems to that end. And so it's been evolving better ways to make these predictions. The first sort of machinery that you could think of as like, you know, stage one prediction algorithms are our instincts. Right. And so we've evolved all these stimulus response circuits that help us instinctually react to things in the world. And they're not very finessed. They kind of give us broad brushstrokes, understandings of the world, but they keep us alive and they keep us procreating and, you know, going forward as a species. Then we evolved what we would call as episodic memory, or a database of our personal experiences. So I could take all the things that have happened to me and I dump it into this database and I've got all this information about what's happened to me personally. Now I can leverage that information to also make a guess about what something is and what it'll, how it'll affect me and what I should do about it. So I've got two different systems that are speaking to these predictions. From there, we evolved the capacity for language. We started dumping our personal experiences into a collective data pool, creating more and more what we would think of as sort of cultural knowledge. And technically we think of this as semantic knowledge. But now we have sort of a cultural system of ideas and constructs that we've all agreed upon that have like sort of shared reality. And that becomes a third lever by which we can interpret and understand the world around us. And then finally develop this capacity in our frontal lobes to internally represent information and data and work with it and do what we now think of as rational thought. So in every given moment of a person's experience, you've essentially got these four little advisors inside of you. You've got your instincts, you have your personal experience, a kind of cultural mind, and a capacity for rational thought. And each one of these can take a swing at whatever pitch is thrown at them. And they can come up with similar outcomes, or they can come up with highly divergent outcomes, depending on the nature of what's going on. And how we orchestrate and utilize these different systems essentially is the unlock code on the nature of how we're navigating through our experiences. And knowing which of these systems is in play for which individuals in relation to what types of experience is like the critical ingredient in being able to predict their behavior dynamics, like their decision-making dynamics. And so that's what we've been doing, is evolving systems. Because I was doing this using brain imaging and, you know, complex methodologies in academia. And the challenge has been is to be able to find ways to get at this kind of information in consumers using surveys. And so we've come up with some pretty interesting methodologies that do things that on the surface wouldn't make a lot of sense to somebody who's taking the survey, but we're extracting tells as to how these decision-making machines are sort of operating in individuals.
So the cogs are going now. I want to give a real world scenario and get your thoughts on it, right? So I think lots and lots of people will go to a doctor with a health condition that is lifestyle based, right? So it might be, I drink too much alcohol, I eat too much food, I don't exercise, I'm not sleeping enough, okay? And the doctor might present that back as evidence saying, if you fixed this thing in your life, you will be better. Then why would the person's response not be to immediately fix that thing? What's the decision making there? If it would help them, and logically I understand it would help me to make that change, why is it so hard to make that change?
Well, because the logical apparatus is one member of the four group band, and the other three band members might have totally different aspirations. And so all of these band members are working against a gradient of anxiety. And the reward is a feeling of control, right? And so each one of them in their own way are constantly trying to create for us better predictions that make us feel more confident and more in control. And so if a person's not accustomed, so across development, people start to experience that these different decision-making lenses or sense-making systems provide different utility. So for one individual in a certain environment, their instinctual lens might have maximum utility for them in the, you know, paces of their day-to-day life. But for another person, their rational sort of sense-making lens might provide the most utility. And over time, they start to develop biases in the way these are orchestrated, right? So a given person in that doctor's office has a pattern in how they orchestrate these systems. And if their rational sort of decision-making lens is temperamentally subjugated, means that it's not often the person at the podium kind of informing most dominantly that person's experience, then their behavior wouldn't be expected to be rational, like at all. A given person's behavior might be being entirely driven by their instinctual system. And so it'll operate within the parameters of that instinctual apparatus, and it'll behave as such, which means acting illogically. And this, I didn't tie it together, but these systems also have very different relationships with states of physiological arousal and emotion intensity, right? And the whole fast thinking, slow thing is embedded in this also. Like instincts happen very quickly. It's like stimulus response. Cultural knowledge, when we trigger a cultural idea in the form of like word structures that we're all familiar with and have shared knowledge about what they mean, that's instantaneous. But when we're mining our personal experience, through, you know, our episodic knowledge to drive a perspective, or when we're doing rational work, that's slow. Or it doesn't have to be slow for the personal experience one, but it can be. And so these systems also inform why our thinking is fast and slow, and how emotionality rises. It's a function of which of these systems is in play as well, because the different systems have different means by which they're vetting the nature of an experience, and what produces an intense emotional response for one might not for another. So understanding, again, which of these is driving the ship is highly informative to like the nature of humans, our personalities, our decisions, our behaviors. It even bears on the type of attention that we apply, because each of these systems prefers different types of information, which modifies the nature of our attention and how it's applied to the world around us. So it really, it determines a great deal about what's going on with humans to understand how these systems are being orchestrated. So the doctor guy might just, he wouldn't, that person in the doctor's office is not subscribing to a rational approach. They're likely using one of these other systems. Just to give an example, someone who comes from a cultural knowledge base that doesn't believe in medicine, and they have a set of cultural precepts that say doctors are worthless. And if they're operating predominantly from that cultural mindset, then that's going to be their takeaway. If they're operating from their personal experience mindset, depending upon what their personal experience says about doctors and their advice, that will inform them. If they're operating from an instinctual one, it'll almost be blank, because to the instinctual stimulus response circuits that we have, the idea of a wise advisor who can optimize your health is just not part of our instinctual circuitry. So they just kind of don't have much of a response to that. And they might try a switch into a rational mindset for the sake of being in the doctor's office. But for many people, that's a very hard state to engage. And they're not adept at using that state very much. And so it sort of falls flat. And then eventually they leave the doctor's office, they go into their habitual state, instincts are running the show, and they're off to whatever the instincts does to make them feel more in control and less anxious.
So there might be people listening to this now, Siggy, that didn't actually know that's how their brain worked or operated. When people start to, I always feel it's a bit like going down the rabbit hole. And once you've started going down, it's like you can't put, you can't shut Pandora's box again. So when people are starting to understand those four band characters that you were talking about, what can people implement in their day-to-day to maybe start making better decisions, maybe start questioning their beliefs, start to hack what's might be true and what might be useful?
Yeah, it's interesting because, well, from a work perspective, we are now confident that we can diagnose how these are being orchestrated in people, which is exciting. So that's one thing. But just in terms of people in the day-to-day lives using this kind of information to improve their lives, it's really cool because if you just start paying attention to it, I mean, you can look at an image and you can just reflect on what are my instincts saying about this? What is my personal experience? Like if you look at it, I don't know, my wife's vegetarian, so I'm always hesitant to use meat analogies, but if you look at a juicy steak, your instincts are definitely going to say something about that because of the instincts to an opportunity for calorie intake and sustenance and things like that. You get the smells and whatnot. It's going to definitely fire off some instincts. And then your personal experience is going to say something. And like, say if you recently had food poisoning from eating a thing like that, then your personal experience might give you a signal. And then you go to a cultural mindset. If you're, you know, if you're a beef rancher in Montana versus like a devout, you know, vegan, you know, so you can start to play these and then you can get into rational thought and say, well, what rationally should I think about? What factual information should apply to this experience? And if you just start paying attention to this, you start to notice that you really do have these different versions of yourself or different sense-making systems in play. And as you become more aware of them, it kind of starts to generate almost like a disembodied meta awareness, like a meta integrator that floats above them all and learns to start consciously orchestrating them. You can kind of be more acutely aware of the goings on of these different guides, so to speak, that are trying to inform your experience and become more conscious about how they're influencing you and learn to use them more proactively. One example is like, if I asked you to define winter, right? And we just said like define winter, people's thoughts would immediately go to a lot of abstract thought and kind of facts and like, well, it's the, you know, the cold season of the year and da, 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 and it happens in these months and da, da. So then if I say, what does winter mean to you personally? Right. Then they start. So what's happening there is you're going from a kind of more rational and perhaps cultural thing. When I say define winter, and then I say, what does winter mean to you? You're going to start conjuring all this episodic data. You're going to start thinking about getting up in the snow and shoveling your driveway and da-da-da-da-da, all these kinds of things. But once you're aware that these different systems are in play and informing your experience, you just start observing them. And you can, and you will observe them in the people around you. And you know that if you're having a discussion with somebody who's deeply embedded in one of these mindsets, you can start to titrate your talk tracks in relation to the mindset that they're the sense-making system that they're using to converse with you. So if someone's in a hyper, say for instance, cultural, they're really relying on their sort of cultural system to kind of navigate a conversation or the world, their reality is being formed by all that cultural ideology and all the sort of consensus knowledge that's embedded in their cultural mind or their group mind. And that's what you're up against. Like that's what you're working against. And if you want to get outside of those parameters, you'd have to shift the conversation over to something that is more personal. That's more about like, okay, let's put them in their episodic knowledge. Let's put them in something that's more forming reality through their direct experiences. And then you can have a very different version of that person to engage with. And this is what's happening like with the exposure therapy and things like that, where someone will have a cultural mindset position that gives them a certain view of the world that might be unhealthy. And then you put them in direct contact via personal direct experience with something that then creates a different version of reality via that other system, which then counters and hopefully eventually overrides the unhealthy one in their cultural system. So you work these against each other all the time. I don't know if that was very clear, but I literally think just knowing about them and starting to observe them in operation leads to lots of natural and intuitive ways to drive your brain through its experiences and interact with people more efficiently. It's like learning that we're all driving manual transmissions and we didn't know it. Oh, there's a third gear. Oh, there's first gear. I know. And we can learn to shift through them more consciously.
I love the breakdown and the explanation of the four characters that you were talking about there. I guess this is probably a two-part question. Are they all equal, or do you find that certain personality types, or is there any kind of evidence to say actually we find that people that have had this kind of life or this kind of life lean into this type of the character more so?
Yeah, absolutely. They're very much a reflection of, again, it's nature and nurture all merged together, And of course, we don't understand nearly close to all of it. I mean, it's like everything is, you know, we're studying the brain. So it's like studying the universe. It's a long road before us. But what we've been able to glean is that there seems to be, as I was mentioning before, a developmental process where people become patterned in the way that they orchestrate these systems. And so if you're in an environment where your instincts are a very good way to deal with your day-to-day life, like say if you're in a very dangerous environment with a lot of threats and possible things that can harm you, it might be very adaptive to have your instinctual system be the primary way by which you navigate the world. Alternatively, you could be in an environment where the things that facilitate your well-being and survival are very much related to a capacity to think rationally. And so like you, so across development as a function of your endowed sort of genetic characteristics working against the environmental pressures that you're experiencing, people will develop patterned expressions of these systems that make sense for them. And that can be, it's interesting because I think an optimal predicament is that a person eventually learns to more fluidly utilize all of these systems more consciously, more dynamically, more adaptively to the specific nuanced conditions of a given circumstance. And we, and so another feature of this is not just how they sort of stack hierarchically, but how much fluidity there is in the way that they're expressed. And we measure that as well, or we try to. Looking at people who seem to be able to have a capacity to flip-flop the way they're orchestrated given different pressures and circumstances, and people who are like, nope, I'm this way, and I kind of stay rigidly like that, almost agnostic to what's happening around me. I think that there's, it's not that there's a, I think the ideal is that we have fluid access to this perspective taking. The reality is that we get patterned in the way that they're expressed. And those patterns are informative to people's personalities, temperaments, decision-making style, sense of the world, intellectual capacities, all kinds of things. Because they bear, you're essentially a different type of nervous system operating under the dictates of these different sense-making systems.
So there's a bit of a buzzword at the minute around being your most authentic self. Now, conversations like this always lead me to a conclusion of, well, surely there can be no such thing, because how is it possible to see ourselves as we actually are with all those different systems working in that way? Even if I think, okay, I'm behaving like this at this moment in time, it might be more my instinct driving that than my rational side. So what do you think around authenticity, and is it actually possible to see yourself as you actually are?
Well, yes, caveat. We are an amalgam of at least four different versions of ourselves, maybe five, if we think of like a kind of disembodied meta awareness that stands above orchestrating these things. And so in my way of thinking, an authentic version of myself is to understand it. We've all had the experience when our instincts have taken over for various reasons, and we behave in ways that seem totally foreign to maybe other aspects of ourselves. Right. And we're like, wait, who was that person? Like, how, you know? Yeah. And so everyone has those kinds of experiences where we have a difficulty time identifying with these different aspects of ourselves that manifest under the guidance of these different systems. And we're like, wow, I didn't know I was capable of that. Da, 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 da. And the point is that that's each of those versions is us. We are an amalgam of these different things. They have qualitatively different sort of features in the categorically different ways in which they interact with the world. And so part of understanding the complexity of a human and the complexity of our self-identity is to become aware of these different things and learn to integrate them and own them as all features of me. Like, I can be a hyper-instinctual being. I can be someone who's very much compelled by the idiosyncratic nature of my personal experience and the accumulated data and how that informs my experience. I can be a social creature who's embedded in this cultural mindset and who's influenced and moved and swayed by it. And then I can be this hyper-rational person who becomes sort of separated out in the domain of logic and reason and facts and act according to those dictates. And the behavior that can come out of each of these systems can seem shockingly dissimilar, but they're all versions of ourselves operating in a different gear.
Interesting. Okay. And then I want to unpack something that you said earlier on around preferences. Okay. So in the modern world, I'm someone who can pick up my phone and have access to a ridiculous amount of information, probably information that I'm not supposed to have access to in that volume. I wonder, our preferences, how much of that is hackable? So how much are they already baked in preferences by media and marketing rather than things that I actually want to have preferences for?
So yeah, this goes back to the mindset dynamic. So when you say I have preferences for, I go to, well, which version of you? And if the version of you that is expressing those preferences really is dominant and flexible, like let's say you're a hyper instinctual person and you tend to remain rigidly so, and a set of preferences has been mapped onto that, your instinctual mind has preferences for things that make sense to it. And so those preferences are going to be a function of the way that that particular lens sees and understands the world and self. And they're going to be pretty rigid inside of that space, inside of that mindset, that way of forming reality and version of self identity. But if you are capable of fluidly shifting to a different version of yourself, we could pull different preferences out of you. If you, you know, if all of a sudden you brain state transitioned and now your rational mind was leading the charge, was guiding you through experiences, I would expect your preference sets to change and adapt based on the different version of the world that you're seeing through that lens. So it's a little bit like, yes, it could be rigid, but we're seeing that there's, it's sort of neurodiversity is such that there's a full spectrum of people in terms of the degree to which they orient towards these different systems and the degree to which they flexibly move between them. And again, sort of mapping this. And what we find is that people who tend to like things similarly tend to orchestrate these systems similarly. And so that's like when we say, this goes up against like the nature of branding and nature of a brand personality. So if a brand personality is presenting itself as something that's seen very favorably by, say, the instinctual mindset, but not the rational, or the rational, but not the instinctual, et cetera, we see that when we stratify people for liking that thing, whatever it is, and then we look and we see that there's a kind of similarity of how these systems are being expressed in the people that similarly like that thing, right? And so that's, I don't know if I've answered your question, but for us, the game is to look at how these systems map onto groups of people that show similarity in the way that they like things. And we're finding that that's very patternable. Like we're finding very robust statistical effects that are being able to show we can identify a kind of shared way in which these systems are orchestrated in relation to a shared set of preferences for things.
Could you give us any, do any examples or kind of anecdotes spring to mind when you're thinking about being patternable?
Yeah, lots. I mean, we've been doing this for so long now. So one example, this is going to seem, it's a very unexciting example, but it was one of the first things I encountered when I came into the market research domain. There was a company that was confused by sentiment around people liking these two different toilet paper products that they had. And they were doing all kinds of focus groups and trying to ask people why they liked or didn't like these two different products that they had. And the data was mixed up with some people really liking product A and disliking product A, and some people really liking and disliking product B. And it just seemed kind of noisy, like in each domain for each of these two products, it was just kind of a mix of liking and disliking. And it was all via focus group kind of data and qualitative data, which is a whole other thing. Like people can't tell you why they like something. They can't. It's like if I ask you why you like blue or why you like strawberries or whatever, you can describe a bunch of phenomenology around it, but there's no way for us to access an understanding of that. It's deep inside of our machinery. But in any case, what we did is we're able to go in and then stratify their data based on this understanding of how the brain works. And then you see very clearly that there was a group of mindsets that had affinity for one of the products and a group of mindsets that had affinity for the other product. And what it was is that one of these products was a very high-end luxury kind of product that was the branding was all around these sort of sensory, the sensory dynamics. It's like, you know, very high-end kind of cush, soft, etc. The other one was very practical, does the job, da, 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 da. So what was happening was that these hyper-rational mindsets were all showing high affinity for the practical product and disliking the more sensory-oriented product. And then there was a sensory mindset that was very much negative about the practical product and very much positive about the sensory-oriented product. And once you stratified their data for these different kinds of mindsets, then it made perfect sense. And then it's like, okay, this product is for this type of mindset. This product is for this type of mindset. So, and we have countless examples of doing things like that in the marketplace.
I love that. And I think that that helps paint the picture in terms of like understanding. What one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Ziggy, is something I've been thinking about the last few days, and I'm sure that you'll be able to conclude some kind of answer, but I've tried to explain it myself. I was listening to a podcast and somebody on the other end of the podcast said that actually when we're experiencing negative thoughts, we're replaying negative situations, it activates the same part of the brain that cocaine activates.
I don't know that in terms of, so cocaine's related to dopamine and reward systems. And the idea is that if we're indulging or ruminating on kind of negative thought structures, that we could be activating dopamine systems. I could see that for sure, because dopamine is related not just to reward, but also to preparing and mobilizing behaviors and actions. So to the extent that negativity and negative thought patterns are linked to, well, I should do something about this. My guess, I'm just totally ripping here, but my guess is that you'd want to distinguish people who are mad and going to do something versus who are just kind of ruminating into stasis. You know, the kind of going into the depression, into the fetal position in the corner of the room in the dark. Like, I'm not sure that would relate to a dopamine response, but I can certainly see negative emotion that's associated with mobilization of doing things that are, that would certainly, I could see that tying to dopamine response. And also taking action under duress can feel very highly rewarding because it provokes a type of control opportunity. And again, dopamine associated with action, being able to take action under duress through anger, frustration, or whatever else, moving towards the opportunity to take control of something that's otherwise vexing and aversive. Those are all potential rewarding features of a brain. So that's the way I would think about that, but I'm just totally riffing on that.
Stay away from cocaine and negative thoughts for people listening at home.
In the conversation that we're having, I would say, and what's important to understand is that the nature of negative thoughts, like the first thing is like, okay, which of these systems is the source of the negative thinking, right? Is it, which of these systems is it coming from? And negativity and positivity arrive in very different ways for these different systems. And if you're in the midst of a very negative thought process and you can identify which of these systems it's emanating from, and you can switch to sort of a different mindset that provokes greater guidance and usage of another system, you can create some distance and objectivity and perspective taking back on the source. It allows you to kind of move away from it. I think good therapists and a lot of the work that we do to help people work through hyper-negative psychology is doing this, without really understanding the machinery, but I think that's what's happening.
It's fascinating. So the systems thinking, the four systems, are we then attracted to people in our lives that share those similar types of systems that we have, or do we look for total opposites? How does that work in terms of professional romantic partners?
Yeah, I mean, this is, again, now we're just riffing, which I'm happy to do, but I will tell you from my my anecdotal experience of studying this stuff for a very long time, that I've come to a theory that essentially is we tend to engage in long-term coupling with people who act as our brain training buddies. So more complementary. So, and in concert, we tend to complement each other. So when you go on vacation, there's the person who's going to be more task oriented and they want to plan and orchestrate, like, I'm going to do this on this day and this on this day. And the other person's going to be like, nope, I just want to wander around and bump into things. And these are, if reflective of different ways of orchestrating these systems and the kinds of behaviors that come out of them. But the point is that by having people who have complementary ways in which these systems are being orchestrated, you're gaining the information through the diverse perspective as a team that these different lenses are providing. And then it also gives each person opportunity to be influenced by the other person and learn to more fluidly move into those brain states that are being well demonstrated by their partner. So, like, in other words, it's a way to provoke us to become more like each other. And over time, that benefits us because then we develop a greater capacity to use these other systems via the influence of this person that complements us in that way.
Interesting. So I suppose it makes sense that, doesn't it? We're tribal animals. I imagine everyone in the tribe would serve a purpose and have different strengths and weaknesses. So I suppose that makes perfect sense. We ask a lot of our guests this question. I'd be interested to see your stance on this. When you think about persuasion, is it possible to persuade someone, or must they persuade themselves?
Or must they persuade themselves? No, they're, well, both. Because, like, if I'm a car salesman and someone comes in and they want to buy a car, a good car salesman probably does this instinct, like intuitively through just doing it for a long time, but they learn very quickly the kinds of information that person's going to need in order to feel positive and make a positive purchase decision. So someone comes in and they need a lot of facts and data about the car, like what's this performance metric. They're using a kind of more rational mind. So another person comes in and they just want to touch the leather and sit in it and see what it feels like. They're gathering personal experience. They're using that personal experience lens, that episodic knowledge, in order to navigate the experience and make the decision. Another person just needs to know that it'll serve the ambitions of their instinctual mindset. You can think of all of the kind of alpha statusy kind of things that would make a caveman, sit up in their chair and be like, that's great. I want to be the alpha caveman kind of person. And you can even a cultural one, and they need information that says, my tribe endorses this. Like my tribe thinks that this decision would be a very good idea. Everyone agrees that this is a great vehicle, and that I'm going to be celebrated and it's going to affirm my belonging in the tribe if I purchase this vehicle, right? And so the salesperson has to figure out which of those talk tracks resonates with the person that they're dealing with best and produces the most positivity. If you have the wrong talk track to the wrong mindset, not only will you not make the sale, you could piss them off. So like someone who's hyper personal in their idiosyncratic experience, they don't care about the group. They don't care if everyone else likes it, or the rational one. You're trying to say, well, everybody loves it. Like, I don't care what everyone else thinks. You can create frustration. And so the person, whatever mindset they're working with, is sitting there and they have to convince themselves. They have to give themselves a feeling of control about the prediction that buying this thing is a good idea. And you need to feed them very different types of information in order, depending upon which system is in play, in order to give that system that feeling of control that they're making a good prediction. So facts and data for the rational one, social consensus for the cultural mind one, positive projected personal experience for the episodic knowledge, the personal experience one, the ones coming from our memory, and then cues to the cave brain that the cave brain would like. You can kind of imagine what those might be. You got a 16-year-old kid who's super instinctual, vying to be the top caveman in his high school. That's a different algorithm that's being run, or a 50-year-old guy who's in a midlife crisis and needs a red Porsche.
Siggy, I've absolutely loved this conversation. I feel like I could pick your brain all day and talk to you. We are running out of time. For anybody that wants to check you out, get in touch with you, quiz you more, find out more about you, where can they get in touch?
Well, you can hit me up on LinkedIn. I'm all over the web, so I'm easy to find. But LinkedIn's probably the best place to get in touch with me. And then where I work. So I work at a place called Alpha Diver. We're in Cincinnati, Ohio, and hit us up on the web. All the things I've been talking about are the things that we do to help people make better sense of the consumers that they're working with.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Siggy.
Thank you so much.
Yep. Great talking to you guys.
Siggy, thanks for being here.
Hey, nice. Thanks you guys for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, no, I'm excited for this one. I'm very excited. So before we get into it, we always start our podcast off the same way. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
I am a brain scientist and I have been working tirelessly for over 20 years now to try to understand essentially the brain's OS, the operating system of the nervous system. So I do systems neuroscience, which means I work at that sort of high level of functionality, looking at large systems and how the large systems interact to inform really the topic of neurodiversity and the way people form experience and make decisions.
Interesting. Okay. And for someone listening to this, is there a particular type of person that you typically help with that? Do they need to have a certain set of symptoms that make it worthwhile listening to the rest of the episode?
Well, when I was in academia, so in my past life, I was a professor at UCLA doing research. And so in that context, I really was just a pure academic, you know, building the body of knowledge for academia. In 2015, I moved into the private sector because doing some consulting work, I kind of discovered a joy for putting scientific knowledge into action to try to solve real world problems. And I was, you know, I very much enjoyed doing that. And so since 2015, I've been doing more market research oriented work. And I would qualify that by saying I didn't jump into doing traditional market research. Instead, what I've been doing is kind of bridging the gap between formal sort of neuroscientific academic approaches to understanding humans and sort of merging that with traditional market research methods, concepts, and approaches. So I've been playing this role of trying to integrate between the two worlds, which has been very interesting on a number of different levels. Yeah.
Nice. Siggy, it's great to have you on the podcast. I sometimes like to go around the houses with my question, but I'm going to ask it in a very simple way today. When you think about the brain, what are some of the surprising things that the brain can do when it comes to influencing our decisions?
Oh, wow. So that delves right into the heart of it. And it relates to the challenge that I've been really facing as I've entered into market research. So maybe I could take that by stepping back a little bit and talking about what are the big differences that I've encountered in being an academic, trying to understand human behavior versus kind of entering the fray of market research. So in market research, historically, they've been really focused on understanding what I think of as what research, kind of getting lots of information about what's happening, what people are doing. And that even delves down to the level of like, what kinds of features do people like about a certain package design or things like that? Do they like this or do they like that? And nevertheless, it's still operating in this domain of what phenomenology, like what's going on? Where are people's eyes and attention going? Where are their preferences settling? Where I've been working is more at why people do those things. And so that opens up the topic of why people would choose, you know, something over something else. And that's an entirely different domain of inquiry. Like, and the complexity of it and the difficulty of it is hard to express how different it is to ask the question, you know, what color does somebody like? Oh, I like blue. Why do I like blue? And delving into the neural underpinnings of what would drive those kinds of preferences. And getting that aspect of understanding of consumers into market research has been the cross that I've been bearing and trying to create mechanisms, try to acculturate ideas, trying to develop nomenclature, means of communicating to be able to interact with people in the market research space, to kind of delve into that. And so to before I'd even explain like what are the nuances of understanding decision-making psychology, it's important to kind of characterize the problem. And the problem really is demonstrated by, you know, we could do lots of things to go, yes, this person likes blue, this person doesn't like blue, but it's really, why do they like blue? And what are the decision-making mechanisms that are fomenting those kinds of sentiment? So I don't know if that's clear, but that's kind of the setting of the stage that would enter into a conversation around the question that you just asked.
And then where do you typically start if you're trying to understand the why? And I'm sure that everybody's individual. Where would you start on that journey then, Siggy?
So, and this is part of the learning that I've been doing over the past 10 years is how to communicate these things, because there's a scientific talk track trajectory, and then there's a more friendly to the public talk track trajectory, and I'll try to stay on that. So, broad brushstrokes. To really get an understanding consumer, the whys behind consumer decision-making, you have to know a couple key things. You have to know the type of decision event that they're up against, and you have to know the type of decision machinery that's in play to make those decisions. So just briefly, when we think about decision, and this relates to this idea, to step back a second, that like nature plus context equals behavior. You know, the whole kind of nature-nurture thing, it's always both. And when I talk about a decision event, I'm talking about a contextual factor. And then in a second, I'll talk about the decision machinery, which is the nature factor, right? And so the context here is when a brand is developing, and this is, again, kind of connects together my academic work and the work I've been doing for the past 10 years in the market research space. But the model is that when a brand is developing, there are three key types of decisions that they have to pass through. The first one can be thought of as decisions associated with trial. Like, will I try this, right? And there's a kind of decision and psychological machinery that goes into that kind of a proposition. Later, they'll get to a point where people are deciding, well, I've tried this several times. It's a point of interest to me. I'm going to onboard something into my more regular daily life routine and pattern behavior. Like, I'm going to decide to make this, like going from dating to like getting engaged. Like, I'm going to now going to make a choice about something that I'm going to use more durably and has become a more regular part of my life and lifestyle. And we think of that as choice. That's a different kind of decision-making event where you're having to make A versus B type of decisions where you're deciding, I'm going to put this in my basket or that in my basket. Whereas during trial, you can walk into a store and be like, I like all the beer. And, you know, I'm going to do this today and that tomorrow. Da, da, da. But people eventually will start to routinize their behavior and get one beer over others more regularly in a patterned way. And that's a different kind of decision. And then further out, people will fall into routinized or automated habitual behavioral patterns where they're just doing something because they're used to doing it. They've done it for a long time. There really isn't a decision happening there per se, but there's a different kind of psychology that's really important in so much as there's a way to protect a routinized behavior or an automatic behavior. Whereas the last thing you want to do is sort of disrupt somebody's automaticity or flow once you've got them in a routinized behavior. And brands make those kinds of mistakes all the time. And there's a whole psychology around optimizing and facilitating a behavior that has become habitualized. So simply, it's like trial, choice, and routine. So those are three kinds of things that brands have to succeed at as they're trying to grow. And once you understand what kind of decision event a brand is up against, then you have to understand the type of decision-making psychology or machinery that their target consumer audience is wielding. And that's where we have to enter into the fray of a kind of deeper conversation about how decision-making processes work in the human brain. So I'll pause there before I go on in case there's any comments or thoughts.
How much then of decision-making, so let's say buying decision-making, if I'm going to make a purchase, is made by the emotional part of the brain rather than the logical part?
Yeah, so this is where we can grow that concept in ways. So it's, yes, there's like emotionality, there's logic, and there's the fast thinking, slow thing nomenclature that's out, but there's a deeper way of understanding this. And the good news is that it's not actually super complex. To put it simply, across evolution, humans have devised, we continue to try to evolve mechanisms that get better and better at making predictions about things in the world that will help us or hurt us. So like the brain is mainly a prediction making machine. It's constantly trying to make guesses like, is this going to help me or is this going to hurt me? And it never has enough information to be 100% confident. So it's really like a probabilistic prediction making mechanism, the human brain and all nervous systems to that end. And so it's been evolving better ways to make these predictions. The first sort of machinery that you could think of as like, you know, stage one prediction algorithms are our instincts. Right. And so we've evolved all these stimulus response circuits that help us instinctually react to things in the world. And they're not very finessed. They kind of give us broad brushstrokes, understandings of the world, but they keep us alive and they keep us procreating and, you know, going forward as a species. Then we evolved what we would call as episodic memory, or a database of our personal experiences. So I could take all the things that have happened to me and I dump it into this database, and I've got all this information about what's happened to me personally. Now I can leverage that information to also make a guess about what something is and what it'll, how it'll affect me and what I should do about it. So I've got two different systems that are speaking to these predictions. From there, we evolved the capacity for language. We started dumping our personal experiences into a collective data pool, creating more and more what we would think of as sort of cultural knowledge. And technically, we think of this as semantic knowledge. But now we have sort of a cultural system of ideas and constructs that we've all agreed upon that have like sort of shared reality. And that becomes a third lever by which we can interpret and understand the world around us. And then finally develop this capacity in our frontal lobes to internally represent information and data and work with it and do what we now think of as rational thought. So in every given moment of a person's experience, you've essentially got these four little advisors inside of you. You've got your instincts, you have your personal experience, a kind of cultural mind, and a capacity for rational thought. And each one of these can take a swing at whatever pitch is thrown at them. And they can come up with similar outcomes, or they can come up with highly divergent outcomes, depending on the nature of what's going on. And how we orchestrate and utilize these different systems essentially is the unlock code on the nature of how we're navigating through our experiences. And knowing which of these systems is in play for which individuals in relation to what types of experience is like the critical ingredient in being able to predict their behavior dynamics, like their decision-making dynamics. And so that's what we've been doing, is evolving systems. Because I was doing this using brain imaging and, you know, complex methodologies in academia. And the challenge has been is to be able to find ways to get at this kind of information in consumers using surveys. And so we've come up with some pretty interesting methodologies that do things that on the surface wouldn't make a lot of sense to somebody who's taking the survey, but we're extracting tells as to how these decision-making machines are sort of operating in individuals.
So the cogs are going now. I want to give a real world scenario and get your thoughts on it, right? So I think lots and lots of people will go to a doctor with a health condition that is lifestyle based, right? So it might be, I drink too much alcohol, I eat too much food, I don't exercise, I'm not sleeping enough, okay? And the doctor might present that back as evidence saying, if you fix this thing in your life, you will be better. Then why would the person's response not be to immediately fix that thing? What's the decision making there? If it would help them, and logically I understand it would help me to make that change, why is it so hard to make that change?
Well, because the logical apparatus is one member of the four group band, and the other three band members might have totally different aspirations. And so all of these band members are working against a gradient of anxiety. And the reward is a feeling of control, right? And so each one of them in their own way are constantly trying to create for us better predictions that make us feel more confident and more in control. And so if a person's not accustomed, so across development, people start to experience that these different decision-making lenses or sense-making systems provide different utilities. So for one individual in a certain environment, their instinctual lens might have maximum utility for them in the, you know, paces of their day-to-day life. But for another person, their rational sort of sense-making lens might provide the most utility. And over time, they start to develop biases in the way these are orchestrated, right? So a given person in that doctor's office has a pattern in how they orchestrate these systems. And if their rational sort of decision-making lens is temperamentally subjugated, means that it's not often the person at the podium kind of informing most dominantly that person's experience, then their behavior wouldn't be expected to be rational, like at all. A given person's behavior might be being entirely driven by their instinctual system. And so it'll operate within the parameters of that instinctual apparatus, and it'll behave as such, which means acting illogically. And this, I didn't tie it together, but these systems also have very different relationships with states of physiological arousal and emotion intensity, right? And the whole fast thinking, slow thing is embedded in this also. Like instincts happen very quickly. It's like stimulus response. Cultural knowledge, when we trigger a cultural idea in the form of like word structures that we're all familiar with and have shared knowledge about what they mean, that's instantaneous. But when we're mining our personal experience, through, you know, our episodic knowledge to drive a perspective, or when we're doing rational work, that's slow. Or it doesn't have to be slow for the personal experience one, but it can be. And so these systems also inform why our thinking is fast and slow, and how emotionality rises. It's a function of which of these systems is in play as well, because the different systems have different means by which they're vetting the nature of an experience, and what produces an intense emotional response for one might not for another. So understanding, again, which of these is driving the ship is highly informative to like the nature of humans, our personalities, our decisions, our behaviors. It even bears on the type of attention that we apply, because each of these systems prefers different types of information, which modifies the nature of our attention and how it's applied to the world around us. So it really, it determines a great deal about what's going on with humans to understand how these systems are being orchestrated. So the doctor guy might just, he wouldn't, that person in the doctor's office is not subscribing to a rational approach. They're likely using one of these other systems. Just to give an example, someone who comes from a cultural knowledge base that doesn't believe in medicine, and they have a set of cultural precepts that say doctors are worthless. And if they're operating predominantly from that cultural mindset, then that's going to be their takeaway. If they're operating from their personal experience mindset, depending upon what their personal experience says about doctors and their advice, that will inform them. If they're operating from an instinctual one, it'll almost be blank, because to the instinctual stimulus response circuits that we have, the idea of a wise advisor who can optimize your health is just not part of our instinctual circuitry. So they just kind of don't have much of a response to that. And they might try to switch into a rational mindset for the sake of being in the doctor's office. But for many people, that's a very hard state to engage. And they're not adept at using that state very much. And so it sort of falls flat. And then eventually they leave the doctor's office, they go into their habitual state, instincts are running the show, and they're off to whatever the instincts does to make them feel more in control and less anxious.
So there might be people listening to this now, Siggy, that didn't actually know that's how their brain worked or operated. When people start to, I always feel it's a bit like going down the rabbit hole. And once you've started going down, it's like you can't put, you can't shut Pandora's box again. So when people are starting to understand those four band characters that you were talking about, what can people implement in their day-to-day to maybe start making better decisions, maybe start questioning their beliefs, start to hack what's might be true and what might be useful?
Yeah, it's interesting, because, well, from a work perspective, we are now confident that we can diagnose how these are being orchestrated in people, which is exciting. So that's one thing. But just in terms of people in the day-to-day lives using this kind of information to improve their lives, it's really cool, because if you just start paying attention to it, I mean, you can look at an image and you can just reflect on, what are my instincts saying about this? What is my personal experience? Like, like if you look at it, I don't know, my wife's vegetarian, so I'm always hesitant to use meat analogies, but if you look at a juicy steak, your instincts are definitely going to say something about that because of the instincts to an opportunity for calorie intake and sustenance and things like that. You get the smells and whatnot. It's going to definitely fire off some instincts. And then your personal experience is going to say something. And like, say if you recently had food poisoning from eating a thing like that, then your personal experience might give you a signal. And then you go to a cultural mindset. If you're, you know, if you're a beef rancher in Montana versus like a devout, you know, vegan, you know, so you can start to play these and then you can get into rational thought and say, well, what rationally should I think about? What factual information should apply to this experience? And if you just start paying attention to this, you start to notice that you really do have these different versions of yourself or different sense-making systems in play. And as you become more aware of them, it kind of starts to generate almost like a disembodied meta awareness, like a meta integrator that floats above them all and learns to start consciously orchestrating them. You can kind of be more acutely aware of the goings on of these different guides, so to speak, that are trying to inform your experience and become more conscious about how they're influencing you and learn to use them more proactively. One example is like if I asked you to define winter, right? And we just said like define winter, people's thoughts would immediately go to a lot of abstract thought and kind of facts and like, well, it's the, you know, the cold season of the year and da 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 da, and it happens in these months and da da. So then if I say, what does winter mean to you personally? Right? Then they start. So what's happening there is you're going from a kind of more rational and perhaps cultural thing. When I say define winter, and then I say, what does winter mean to you? You're going to start conjuring all this episodic data. You're going to start thinking about getting up in the snow and shoveling your driveway and da, 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 all these kinds of things. But once you're aware that these different systems are in play and informing your experience, you just start observing them and you can, and you will observe them in the people around you. And you know that if you're having a discussion with somebody who's deeply embedded in one of these mindsets, you can start to titrate your talk tracks in relation to the mindset that they're the sense-making system that they're using to converse with you. So if someone's in a hyper, say for instance, cultural, they're really relying on their sort of cultural system to kind of navigate a conversation or the world, their reality is being formed by all that cultural ideology and all the sort of consensus knowledge that's embedded in their cultural mind or their group mind. And that's what you're up against. Like that's what you're working against. And if you want to get outside of those parameters, you'd have to shift the conversation over to something that is more personal. That's more about like, okay, let's put them in their episodic knowledge. Let's put them in something that's more forming reality through their direct experiences. And then you can have a very different version of that person to engage with. And this is what's happening like with exposure therapy and things like that, where someone will have a cultural mindset position that gives them a certain view of the world that might be unhealthy. And then you put them in direct contact via personal direct experience with something that then creates a different version of reality via that other system, which then counters and hopefully eventually overrides the unhealthy one in their cultural system. So you can, you work these against each other all the time. I don't know if that was very clear, but I literally think just knowing about them and starting to observe them in operation leads to lots of natural and intuitive ways to drive your brain through its experiences and interact with people more efficiently. It's like learning that we're all driving manual transmissions and we didn't know it. Oh, there's a third gear. Oh, there's first gear. I know. And we can learn to shift through them more consciously.
I love the breakdown and the explanation of the four characters that you were talking about there. I guess this is probably a two-part question. Are they all equal, or do you find that certain personality types, or is there any kind of evidence to say, actually, we find that people that have had this kind of life or this kind of life lean into this type of the character more so?
Yeah, absolutely. They're very much a reflection of, again, it's nature and nurture all merged together. And of course, we don't understand nearly close to all of it. I mean, it's like everything is, you know, we're studying the brain. So it's like studying the universe. It's a long road before us. But what we've been able to glean is that there seems to be, as I was mentioning before, a developmental process where people become patterned in the way that they orchestrate these systems. And so if you're in an environment where your instincts are a very good way to deal with your day-to-day life, like say if you're in a very dangerous environment with a lot of threats and possible things that can harm you, it might be very adaptive to have your instinctual system be the primary way by which you navigate the world. Alternatively, you could be in an environment where the things that facilitate your well-being and survival are very much related to a capacity to think rationally. And so across development, as a function of your endowed sort of genetic characteristics working against the environmental pressures that you're experiencing, people will develop patterned expressions of these systems that make sense for them. And that can be, it's interesting because I think an optimal predicament is that a person eventually learns to more fluidly utilize all of these systems more consciously, more dynamically, more adaptively to the specific nuanced conditions of a given circumstance. And so another feature of this is not just how they sort of stack hierarchically, but how much fluidity there is in the way that they're expressed. And we measure that as well, or we try to, looking at people who seem to be able to have a capacity to flip-flop the way they're orchestrated given different pressures and circumstances, and people who are like, nope, I'm this way, and I kind of stay rigidly like that, almost agnostic to what's happening around me. I think that there's it's not that there's a, I think the ideal is that we have fluid access to this perspective taking. The reality is that we get patterned in the way that they're expressed. And those patterns are informative to people's personalities, temperaments, decision-making style, sense of the world, intellectual capacities, all kinds of things. Because they bear, you're essentially a different type of nervous system operating under the dictates of these different sense-making systems.
So there's a bit of a buzzword at the minute around being your most authentic self. Now, conversations like this always lead me to a conclusion of, well, surely there can be no such thing, because how is it possible to see ourselves as we actually are with all those different systems working in that way? Even if I think, okay, I'm behaving like this at this moment in time, it might be more my instinct driving that than my rational side. So what do you think around authenticity, and is it actually possible to see yourself as you actually are?
Well, yes, caveat. We are an amalgam of at least four different versions of ourselves, maybe five, if we think of like a kind of disembodied meta awareness that stands above orchestrating these things. And so in my way of thinking, an authentic version of myself is to understand it. We've all had the experience when our instincts have taken over for various reasons, and we behave in ways that seem totally foreign to maybe other aspects of ourselves. Right. And we're like, wait, who was that person? Like, how, you know? Yeah. And so everyone has those kinds of experiences where we have a difficulty time identifying with these different aspects of ourselves that manifest under the guidance of these different systems. And we're like, wow, I didn't know I was capable of that. Da, 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 da. And the point is that each of those versions is us. We are an amalgam of these different things. They have qualitatively different sort of features in the categorically different ways in which they interact with the world. And so part of understanding the complexity of a human and the complexity of our self-identity is to become aware of these different things and learn to integrate them and own them as all features of me. Like, I can be a hyper instinctual being. I can be someone who's very much compelled by the idiosyncratic nature of my personal experience and the accumulated data and how that informs my experience. I can be a social creature who's embedded in this cultural mindset and who's influenced and moved and swayed by it. And then I can be this hyper-rational person who becomes sort of separated out in the domain of logic and reason and facts and act according to those dictates. And the behavior that can come out of each of these systems can seem shockingly dissimilar, but they're all versions of ourselves operating in a different gear.
Interesting. Okay. And then I want to unpack something that you said earlier on around preferences. Okay. So in the modern world, I'm someone who can pick up my phone and have access to a ridiculous amount of information, probably information that I'm not supposed to have access to in that volume. I wonder our preferences, how much of that is hackable? So how much are they already baked in preferences by media and marketing rather than things that I actually want to have preferences for?
So yeah, this goes back to the mindset dynamic. So when you say I have preferences for, I go to, well, which version of you? And if the version of you that is expressing those preferences really is dominant and flexible, like let's say you're a hyper instinctual person and you tend to remain rigidly so, and a set of preferences has been mapped onto that, your instinctual mind has preferences for things that make sense to it. And so those preferences are going to be a function of the way that that particular lens sees and understands the world and self. And they're going to be pretty rigid inside of that space, inside of that mindset, that way of forming reality and version of self identity. But if you are capable of fluidly shifting to a different version of yourself, we could pull different preferences out of you. If you, you know, if all of a sudden you brain state transitioned and now your rational mind was leading the charge, was guiding you through experiences, I would expect your preference sets to change and adapt based on the different version of the world that you're seeing through that lens. So it's a little bit like, yes, it could be rigid, but we're seeing that there's, it's sort of neurodiversity is such that there's a full spectrum of people in terms of the degree to which they orient towards these different systems and the degree to which they flexibly move between them. Again, sort of mapping this. And what we find is that people who tend to like things similarly tend to orchestrate these systems similarly. And so that's like when we say, and this goes up against like the nature of branding and nature of a brand personality. So if a brand personality is presenting itself as something that's seen very favorably by, say, the instinctual mindset, but not the rational, or the rational, but not the instinctual, et cetera, we see that when we stratify people for liking that thing, whatever it is, and then we look and we see that there's a kind of similarity of how these systems are being expressed in the people that similarly like that thing. Right. And so I don't know if I've answered your question, but for us, the game is to look at how these systems map onto groups of people that show similarity in the way that they like things. And we're finding that that's very patternable. Like we're finding very robust statistical effects that are being able to show we can identify a kind of shared way in which these systems are orchestrated in relation to a shared set of preferences for things.
Could you give us any examples or kind of anecdotes spring to mind when you're thinking about being patternable?
Yeah, lots. I mean, we've been doing this for so long now. So one example, this is going to seem, it's a very unexciting example, but it was one of the first things I encountered when I came into the market research domain. There was a company that was confused by sentiment around people liking these two different toilet paper products that they had. And they were doing all kinds of focus groups and trying to ask people why they liked or didn't like these two different products that they had. And the data was mixed up with some people really liking product A and disliking product A, and some people really liking and disliking product B. And it just seemed kind of noisy, like in each domain for each of these two products, it was just kind of a mix of liking and disliking. And it was all via focus group kind of data and qualitative data, which is a whole other thing. Like people can't tell you why they like something. They can't. It's like, if I ask you why you like blue or why you like strawberries or whatever, you can describe a bunch of phenomenology around it, but there's no way for us to access an understanding of that. It's deep inside of our machinery. But in any case, what we did is we're able to go in and then stratify their data based on this understanding of how the brain works. And then you see very clearly that there was a group of mindsets that had affinity for one of the products and a group of mindsets that had affinity for the other product. And what it was is that one of these products was a very high-end luxury kind of product that was the branding was all around these sort of sensory, the sensory dynamics. It's like, you know, very high-end kind of cush, soft, etc. The other one was very practical, does the job, da, 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 da. So what was happening was that these hyper-rational mindsets were all showing high affinity for the practical product and disliking the more sensory-oriented product. And then there was a sensory mindset that was very much negative about the practical product and very much positive about the sensory-oriented product. And once you stratified their data for these different kinds of mindsets, then it made perfect sense. And then it's like, okay, this product is for this type of mindset. This product is for this type of mindset. So, and we have countless examples of doing things like that in the marketplace.
I love that. And I think that that helps paint the picture in terms of like understanding what one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Siggy, is something I've been thinking about the last few days. And it, I'm sure that you'll be able to conclude some kind of answer. But I've tried to explain it myself. I was listening to a podcast and somebody on the other end of the podcast said, actually, when we're experiencing negative thoughts, we're replaying negative situations, it activates the same part of the brain that cocaine activates.
I don't know that in terms of, so cocaine's related to dopamine and reward systems. And the idea is that if we're indulging or ruminating on kind of negative thought structures, that we could be activating dopamine systems. I could see that for sure, because dopamine is related not just to reward, but also to preparing and mobilizing behaviors and actions. So to the extent that negativity and negative thought patterns are linked to, well, I should do something about this. My guess, I'm just totally ripping here, but my guess is that you would want to distinguish people who are mad and going to do something versus who are just kind of ruminating into stasis. You know, the kind of going into the depression, into the fetal position in the corner of the room in the dark. Like, I'm not sure that would relate to a dopamine response, but I can certainly see negative emotion that's associated with mobilization of doing things that are, that would certainly, I could see that tying to dopamine response. And also taking action under duress can feel very highly rewarding because it provokes a type of control opportunity. And again, dopamine associated with action, being able to take action under duress through anger, frustration, or whatever else, moving towards the opportunity to take control of something that's otherwise vexing and aversive. Those are all potential rewarding features of a brain. So that's the way I would think about that, but I'm just totally riffing on that.
Stay away from cocaine and negative thoughts for people listening at home.
In the conversation that we're having, I would say, and what's important to understand is that the nature of negative thoughts, like the first thing is like, okay, which of these systems is the source of the negative thinking, right? Is it, which of these systems is it coming from? And negativity and positivity arrive in very different ways for these different systems. And if you're in the midst of a very negative thought process and you can identify which of these systems it's emanating from, and you can switch to sort of a different mindset that provokes greater guidance and usage of another system, you can create some distance and objectivity and perspective taking back on the source. It allows you to kind of move away from it. I think good therapists and a lot of the work that we do to help people work through hyper-negative psychology is doing this, without really understanding the machinery, but I think that's what's happening.
It's fascinating. So the systems thinking, the four systems, are we then attracted to people in our lives that share those similar types of systems that we have, or do we look for total opposites? How does that work in terms of professional romantic partners?
Yeah, I mean, this is again, then now we're just riffing, which I'm happy to do, but I will tell you from my anecdotal experience of studying this stuff for a very long time, that I've come to a theory that essentially is we tend to engage in long-term coupling with people who act as our brain training buddies. So more complementary. So, and in concert, we tend to complement each other. So when you go on vacation, there's the person who's going to be more task oriented and they want to plan and orchestrate, like, I'm going to do this on this day and this on this day. And the other person's going to be like, nope, I just want to wander around and bump into things. And these are reflective of different ways of orchestrating these systems and the kinds of behaviors that come out of them. But the point is that by having people who have complementary ways in which these systems are orchestrating, being orchestrated, you're gaining the information through the diverse perspective as a team that these different lenses are providing. And then it also gives each person opportunity to be influenced by the other person and learn to more fluidly move into those brain states that are being well demonstrated by their partner. So, like, in other words, it's a way to provoke us to become more like each other. And over time, that benefits us because then we develop a greater capacity to use these other systems via the influence of this person that complements us in that way.
Interesting. So I suppose it makes sense then, doesn't it? We're tribal animals. I imagine everyone in the tribe would serve a purpose and have different strengths and weaknesses. So I suppose that makes perfect sense. We ask a lot of our guests this question. I'd be interested to see your stance on this. When you think about persuasion, is it possible to persuade someone, or must they persuade themselves?
Or must they persuade themselves? No, both, because, like, if I'm a car salesman and someone comes in and they want to buy a car, a good car salesman probably does this intuitively through just doing it for a long time, but they learn very quickly the kinds of information that person's going to need in order to feel positive and make a positive purchase decision. So someone comes in and they need a lot of facts and data about the car, like, what's this performance metric? What's this performance metric? They're using a kind of more rational mind. So another person comes in and they just want to touch the leather and sit in it and see what it feels like. They're gathering personal experience. They're using that personal experience lens, that episodic knowledge, in order to navigate the experience and make the decision. Another person just needs to know that it'll serve the ambitions of their instinctual mindset. You can think of all of the kind of alpha statusy kind of things that would make a caveman, sit up in their chair and be like, that's great. I want to be the alpha caveman type of person. And you can even cultural one, and they need information that says, my tribe endorses this. Like, my tribe thinks that this decision would be a very good idea. Everyone agrees that this is a great vehicle, and that I'm going to be celebrated and it's going to affirm my belonging in the tribe if I purchase this vehicle, right? And so the salesperson has to figure out which of those talk tracks resonates with the person that they're dealing with best and produces the most positivity. If you have the wrong talk track to the wrong mindset, not only will you not make the sale, you could piss them off. So, like, someone who's hyper personal in their idiosyncratic experience, they don't care about the group. They don't care if everyone else likes it, or the rational one. You're trying to say, well, everybody loves, like, I don't care what everyone else thinks. You can create frustration. And so the person, whatever mindset they're working with, is sitting there and they have to convince themselves. They have to give themselves a feeling of control about the prediction that buying this thing is a good idea. And you need to feed them very different types of information in order, depending upon which system is in play, in order to give that system that feeling of control that they're making a good prediction. So facts and data for the rational one, social consensus for the cultural mind one, positive projected personal experience for the episodic knowledge, the personal experience one, the one coming from our memory, and then cues to the cave brain that the cave brain would like. You can kind of imagine what those might be. You got a 16-year-old kid who's super instinctual, vying to be the top caveman in his high school. That's a different algorithm that's being run, or a 50-year-old guy who's in a midlife crisis and needs a red Porsche,
Siggy, I've absolutely loved this conversation. I feel like I could pick your brain all day and talk to you. We are running out of time. For anybody that wants to check you out, get in touch with you, quiz you more, find out more about you, where can they get in touch?
Well, you can hit me up on LinkedIn. I'm all over the web, so I'm easy to find. But LinkedIn's probably the best place to get in touch with me. And then where I work. So I work at a place called Alpha Diver. We're in Cincinnati, Ohio. And hit us up on the web. All the things I've been talking about are the things that we do to help people make better sense of the consumers that they're working with.
Brilliant. Thank you so much again.
Thank you so much.